This podcast brought to you by Peterson Auto Group. With 5 stores and 10 brands and more than 1,800 new and used vehicles to choose from, Peterson Auto Group likely has your perfect car. This hour brought to you by A1 Heating and Air. Stay cool and comfy this summer with A1 Heating and Air Conditioning. Visit A1Heating.com.
If you're talking about it...
They don't care about the view. They're not there for a discussion.
We're talking about it.
Let's take a deep breath and not get too carried away.
This is Idaho Talks Live with Paul J. Schneider and Chris Walton on News Talk 670 KBOI.
Well, let's start off this morning with the Lyle Smith thing, a story which broke just as we were getting off the air yesterday. The fact that the legendary Boise State coach had passed away at 101, mm-hmm. and so we missed it for the show yesterday, but we'd be remiss if we didn't I mentioned it today. The guy meant so much to Boise State Athletics, the Boise State football, the city of Boise, and Boise's first baby steps nationally, if you will, onto that main stage mm-hmm. and won the national championship in junior college football.
You had an interesting point this morning because people asked at the time that Lyle Smith stepped down as head football coach. I mean, he was the athletic director.
Correct.
So he hired Tony Knapp. It was because Boise State was going from, it was Boise Junior College, and it was going from Boise Junior College to Boise College and then later Boise State College and
right.
and Boise State University, which happened, you know, rather quickly. But 1968 was the first year as a 4-year school. And you said that basically Lyle Smith just didn't want people to think this was just an extension of Boise Junior College. He wanted people to think this is a brand new beginning, you know, as a four year school. And of course, the Tony Knapp hire was a great hire.
No question.
And part of the goal at Boise State was to simply get the University of Idaho on the schedule, which they did, and then eventually beat them once in a while.
Yeah, Knapp lost his first game to Linfield. Then he won a game. Then I think he lost his next game, and he was 2-3. And Lyle Smith was retired, and mm-hmm. people were looking at him going, "What have we done?"
But then what happened?
He won 22 straight.
And then people were like, "Now who was
everybody
the previous?
Went,
Whatever happened to that previous coach? I don't know. He's running."
Yeah. Were we upset that what's his name isn't coaching anymore? But it was pretty cool. But you had to think that ego-wise, or however you want to put it,
mm-hmm.
that
was tough.
It was tough on Lyle.
I'm sure it would have been.
And not the greatest.
But he didn't act like an egomaniac at all, ever.
He never did, and never was. The guy was... He was incredible.
I know you interviewed him and talked to him extensively at different times. I really only had one. Well, I mean, I'd see him at events and say hi, coach, and stuff like that. And he'd say he was very nice. He'd always say hello. But only once did I ever have a chance to talk to him much, because we got seated next to each other at a banquet. This is maybe like 20 years ago or so. And of course, we talked about any football. And It was kind of funny, because the one thing I remember him saying that's always stuck with me, he says, "Well, you know, back in those days," he says, we used to mostly run the ball. We didn't pass much, because there's only three.
Single wing, baby.
Yeah, because he said there's only three things that happen when you pass, and two of them are bad.
Yep, interceptions. You know, because
interceptions and incompletions.
Yeah.
And then there's, of course, the possibility of a completion. But, you know, he figured if
way
you
down
could,
the list.
If you could put together a good enough scheme to, blocking and whatnot to run the ball, just run the ball.
Yeah, and an interesting guy, and renowned for his cheapness. Renowned.
Thrift.
Thrift. and we've had guys in here. Remember, who was it was in there? Oh, Greg Patton,
mm-hmm.
the tennis coach. Remember talking about how cheap Lyle was?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. And pretty incredible stuff. And he had to make do.
Yeah.
On shoestrings for so long.
That makes you thrifty.
Second nature.
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
And plus, I mean, at 101 years old, obviously, I mean, he was born in 1916. Or was it either 1915 or 1916? But anyway, he, you know, obviously he was already an adult or so, or a high school kid by the time the Depression hit.
Mm-hmm.
And as just about anybody who lived through the Depression knows, you learned to be thrifty. You learned to use what you had, and you learned to make do with if you didn't have something.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Our condolences to his family. And Lyle Smith, dead at 101.
Mm-hmm.
KBOI News Time, 8:45.
Remember, you are listening to Paul, Jay, and Chris on 670 KBOI.
All right, we are back. KBOI News Time, 8:50.
A lot of people are afraid of losing their ability to afford health care.
Yep.
And I think most of the people that are afraid of it are ones who, you know, before the Affordable Care Act simply couldn't. And so they didn't have any insurance of any kind.
And holes.
Yeah, and quite often those are people, they're not destitute. So they're not...
Exactly.
Or they weren't at that time, they weren't eligible for Medicaid. And, you know, they maybe make a little bit of money, have a job, something like that, but it's not a particularly great job. It's mm-hmm. not... you know, giving them really any disposable income or anything like that. And so among the things that they can't afford to do is simply to insure their family. And it's like I said, I mean, you know, obviously it's been years that premiums and deductibles have been going up. It was before Obamacare that they were going up. I used to get fairly disgusted. I can remember even back in the late 90s and... you know, after like, you know, 2000, 2001, 2002, because it seemed like we would have a meeting every year where there would be a new insurance plan.
Right.
And the only difference between it and the previous, and it always gives like a booklet, you know, here's how to fill the thing out and here's how to do all this stuff. And it was really simple.
Yeah.
Because they'd be offering the same stuff as the previous year, but maybe with a new company. But the difference would be your premium would be higher than it was the previous year. And your deductible would also be higher. And this happened every single year.
Yep.
And then, of course, after the Affordable Care Act, it still happened for people who were paying for their own. And with, you know, this fear that's been building around the nation, especially with the people who 20 million or so who got on insurance with the Affordable Care Act and then would be taken off it. If it went away, even if it, you know, took 2 years.
Sure.
Last night, an estimated 80 people gathered in front of the Capitol building here, Idaho's State House, downtown, to protest the recent health care debates in Congress. United Vision for Idaho is a group, probably known as a liberal group. They helped organize what they called an accountability vigil and die-in, in which protesters... basically laid down on the ground as if they were dead and held tombstones. The die-in, and we've seen this on TV from around the country. They've done this in front of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and most every other capital. The die-in represented the potential deaths, they said, that could come for those left without accessible and affordable health care. Now, the protest came amid the U.S. Senate's so far unsuccessful attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
Right.
And protesters opposed several of the proposed replacement bills or the lack of replacement options. When congressmen talk about this, they essentially say, when senators and congressmen talk about it, they say, well, it's in the early stages. We're still trying to figure out what would be the best way to make everybody happy. And I think if we've learned anything from history, the one thing you can't do is make everybody happy.
See, one of the major problems here is, like, take my situation. I have a wife who is 20 years younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
My insurance, I mean, I can go on Medicaid, Medicare.
Medicare, yeah.
Yeah, right, anytime. She can't.
Right.
She's still got 20 years to go. And her insurance now is at its most expensive because of her age and pre-existing conditions and all kinds of things. So it's a real concern for us. Do we know for sure we're going to get hammered? No, but yeah. I mean, we're going to get hammered, but we don't know to what extent yet.
Yeah.
But for a 10-year period, and that'll be 10 years. Now, see, if I want to retire,
right?
And if I retire, then she's on my insurance now, so no big deal. But if I retire, then she has to have her own insurance, which is very expensive.
And considering she's self-employed, it would be...
Self-employed, exactly.
It wouldn't be a group insurance deal.
Yeah, well, yeah, it could be.
Concerns by protesters included Medicaid cuts, being denied insurance coverage due to pre-existing conditions, as you said, and losing coverage altogether. The cardboard tombstones protesters held read statements such as "food over meds" or "killed by a preventable disease" or "died in a nursing home at age 25. Somebody that I know from Canada wrote the other day, and I didn't write back or anything, but I did read what they had to say. And, of course, you know, Canada, they have the universal health care up there.
You bet.
Where essentially you pay more in taxes than the government pays for everybody's health care. And, you know, and whether you think that's a good thing or not, it just is what it is up there.
Yeah.
And this individual
and
said,
this exact point in time would be a good thing for me.
This individual said, you know what? I don't mind paying more in taxes if it means that, you know, some kid in Alberta, some 5-year-old kid gets a heart operation that saves his life, or some, you know, 80-year-old guy in Toronto gets medication that he otherwise couldn't afford. He said, you know, it doesn't matter to him. Well, Canada has a little bit of a different deal because they have considerably fewer people than the United States.
Correct.
And while it probably wouldn't be impossible for the United States to go on a universal health care program, which, you know, when the Affordable Health Care came out was sort of that was the aim. They wanted to go toward that. It would still, I mean, it would be very, very expensive. And I don't know what it would do to people in terms of how much they'd have to pay in taxes. But, you know, if you think we're already paying way too much in taxes for way too many things, then this is why so many people are protesting against this. It's not because they hate other people. It's 8:56. We'll be back.
This hour brought to you by A1 Heating and Air. Stay cool and comfy this summer with A1 Heating and Air Conditioning. Visit A1Heating.com.
If you're talking about it,
they don't care about the view. They're not there for a discussion.
We're talking about it.
Let's take a deep breath and not get too carried away.
This is Idaho Talks Live with Paul J. Schneider and Chris Walton on News Talk 670 KBOI.
Welcome back. Interesting day.
You know, Anthony Scaramucci.
Yes.
He is
in the news today.
Well, he is. He's definitely...
he is confrontational. My God.
He's definitely making himself known at the White House. And this was fairly unusual this morning. He called into CNN, the new White House communications director, and of course Sean Spicer is gone now.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Dancing with the Stars is trying to
get him to appear.
Yeah, get Sean Spicer to appear on their show, and I'm thinking, you know, if enough people aren't making fun of him now, that should do it.
Yeah, if you're not a dancer,
yeah,
I'm thinking the last thing you want to get to do is get out there and stare a camera down and shake your hips. I'm thinking you don't want to do that.
You know what's funny is on that show, you can't compete if you're a professional dancer.
Uh-huh.
But it always seems like the ones who win are people who, well, occasionally it's a sports star that wins, like, you know, Emmett Smith or
Jerry Rice or somebody like that.
Yeah, because they are fit. But also, most of the time, the ones who win are people who are entertainers who, as part of their, as part of what they do as an entertainer, they've had some dancing experience.
And no inhibitions.
Yeah. But anyway, Anthony Scaramucci defended himself after a deleted overnight tweet and railed against leaks coming from the White House and elsewhere. Scaramucci said that he had a good idea of who the senior leakers are in the White House, but that he was more concerned with
that just sounds bad.
Higher profile leaks on national security issues.
Senior leaker.
Well, yeah, well, exactly.
Sounds bad.
But kind of sounds like something people would be used to.
hey.
But basically, well, no, I'm not. You know,
talk about me, boy.
Present company accepted. But basically, he was talking about Reince Priebus, who is the chief of staff.
Correct.
And as such, is his immediate boss. Now, do you really think Reince Priebus would be the person leaking stories from the White House? And if so, to what end?
See, and that is always my question. Who? Why?
Well,
answer me those two questions.
Those are actually two good ones.
Yeah. Okay, and we get callers all the time that say, well, they want you to believe that they do. Well, who is they?
Yeah, exactly.
And what are they going to gain from all this?
I got into a discussion one time, and it was on this program, with a guy who he kept saying, they want this and they want that.
Yeah.
And I said, basically, I said, now, who are they? And he says, well, you know, the government. And I said, well, okay, but who in the government? And he just kept going, well, the government. Well, to him, the government was, you know, like 10 or 12 people that made all the decisions for everything that goes on in the entire United States. And I said, you know, the government's an awful lot of people. There are certain people who are the decision makers and are in charge and whatnot. But if you're talking about, like, for instance, Timothy McVeigh and those guys.
Right.
They were mad at the government, so they blew up a building and killed 100 and some people. Well, those were basically, a lot of them were just people with jobs, you know, that just happened to be in a building where they had a government job.
Collateral damage.
And they had absolutely nothing to do
right
with anything that was going on. But Anthony Scaramucci basically said that this morning on television, and he kind of said this in the tweet last night, that Reince Priebus should prove he is not a leaker. He is not the person who is leaking stuff at the White House. And it just seems weird for somebody to challenge the chief of staff in that way. Assuming that's, you know, what you believe he meant by that. Which, to me, it seems kind of clear.
Yeah.
But they're calling it a knife fight for control of the West Wing. Was broken open this morning. That's what the LA Times has to say. As President Trump's new communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, lashed out at White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus in a televised interview, accusing Priebus of leaking and standing in the way of Trump's agenda. The fish stinks from the head down. I can tell you two fish that don't stink, okay? And that's me and the president, Scaramucci. Is he going for Priebus's job here?
Yeah.
It feels like he is.
Yeah.
Scaramucci said, calling into CNN's morning show New Day, he said, I don't like the activity that's going on at the White House. Scaramucci, who had said the day he was named to the White House job that he and Priebus were like brothers, apparently they also fight like brothers, drastically amended that in the interview, comparing the two of them to the brothers who in the Bible were the characters in the first murder, Cain
and
Abel. This
is so bizarre. We are in such a bizarre place.
Mm-hmm. Some brothers are like Cain and Abel. Other brothers can fight with each other and get along. I don't know if this is repairable or not. That will be up to the president, he said. Well, and a lot of this is up to the president. It's not going to be up to Scaramucci. You're not supposed to be anyway. The president has a track record of encouraging rivalries among people who work for him. And to a certain extent, I mean, we've talked about that a lot before. If you have competition, there's a certain belief, and certain people will rise to the top with competition in a way that they won't if they don't have any. You know, they will get better if the competition is better.
Yep.
And so within his organizations in the past, he has tried to have people compete against each other. You know, like even on that TV show of his where he would say The Apprentice, where he would say, you're fired, you know, even on that, it was people competing against each other just to see who, you know, rose up higher and got a better job. But Scaramucci said he had spoken with the president for 15 minutes to go over what he was going to say before he called CNN.
Yeah.
Implying that his warnings to Priebus actually had the backing of the president. According to Scaramucci,
there's a
Trump,
lot of implication
yeah,
here.
According to Scaramucci, Trump has given me his full support and his full blessing. When Scaramucci was hired, Mooch, they call him. That's his nickname, you know, for Scaramucci, obviously.
Nice.
And every day somebody makes a joke on Facebook or Twitter about, because there's a line in Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, Scaramouche, Scaramouche, can you do the Fandango? And people keep saying, you know, when's he going to do the Fandango?
Thunder and lightning.
Yeah, very, very frightening me, Galileo. But when Scaramouche was hired, the president told him he would report directly to him, the president, bypassing the chief of staff and setting up the clash that played out this morning on national television. If you want to talk about the chief of staff, we have had odds. We have had differences. When I said we were brothers from the podium, that's because we're rough on each other, Scaramucci said. The tension between himself and Priebus flared after Politico published a story yesterday about Scaramucci's publicly available financial disclosure form showing that he still stands to profit from his stake in an investment firm that he founded, which is being right now sold to the Chinese. The disclosure form was available to the public because Scaramucci had been nominated earlier this year for a job at the Export-Import Bank of the U.S., and the forms became public 30 days after they are filed. That's just what happens. But Scaramucci, in a tweet last night, seemed to imply Priebus had leaked the form to make him look bad or knew who did and called for an FBI investigation, even though, as we said, it's a public document. He later deleted the tweet, apparently after being informed that the form wasn't leaked. Over the last 5 days, Scaramucci said to CNN he has done a major amount of work interviewing assistants to the president and communication staff. He also had dinner with the president Wednesday night, in addition to his phone conversation that they had this morning. The two of them want everyone to know we have a very, very good idea of who the leakers are, who the senior leakers are in the White House. Scaramucci took aim specifically at Priebus for leaking details about internal White House discussions and maneuvers. He said if Reince wants to explain that he's not a leaker, let him do that. Well, I mean, is that what you do if you work with somebody in the White House? Is you go on TV and say, you know, I need him to explain that he's not the one doing this? Or do you just
maybe
take care of it in-house?
You know, I'm actually looking forward to Melania Trump going out on the road with Prince Harry just to
have something a little lighter going
just
on.
Just have something lighter.
Yeah.
Let's rearrange our focus a little bit and stop being so stupid.
All right.
9:17.
Well, we need to take a break. When we come back, I've got a little bit to read from a column that's an analysis of what they call the president's war against elites, but also against expertise. We'll be back.
This is Idaho Talks Live with Paul, Jay, and Chris. More local talk with Nate Shellman is live this afternoon at 3 on 670 KBOI.
Paul, Jay, and Chris, you're back.
When
9:22.
When the president was campaigning, one of his big issues was, you know, what he called draining the swamp.
Draining the swamp.
And by the way, our rewards code today is leakers. L E A K E R S.
Could it be anything else?
As in the kinds of boats you do not want to purchase. L E A K E R S. Leakers. But he wanted to drain the swamp, which I think to him meant to get rid of what we call the Washington elite, people who had been in Washington a long time. And I think he was thinking of bureaucrats,
mm-hmm.
people who have had government jobs where, you know, depending, it didn't matter whose administration they were under, they just kept the same job. And to a certain extent, there have been times in the past 6 months when people have said, well, it would be nice if he had more of those people still around because they knew procedure. And so you wouldn't have to spend so much time explaining to people why you did something a certain way, you know, just, you know, still put into place your agenda, but do it in the same way that Washington always had. And there are plenty of other people who say, no, you know, the reason they like Trump is because he doesn't do things the way other presidents have done, because they've just been sick of it for, you know, decades, if not just a few years. But there is this idea that he said he wanted to get rid of the elites, but there is a certain group of people who believe that what he meant was he wanted to get rid of know-it-alls.
Right.
And the only problem with know-it-alls is, well, if you're talking about people who don't really know things and think they do, yeah, and that's one thing. But if you're talking about getting rid of people who actually do know things, you know, if you're running any kind of a business, you kind of need those people.
Yes.
You need people around who understand procedures. You know, if you're going overseas, you need people who understand protocol and understand the country to which you are traveling.
That's like these people, Chris, who want to replace the entire Congress every year.
Yeah.
Or every 2 years or every six years.
To a certain extent, that would be...
You can't do it because you spend all your time training people.
Yeah, you'd have to teach people how to, you know, to write a bill, how to read a bill.
It doesn't work.
During the Johnson administration, he went to, and I'm trying to remember, it was either Indonesia or Malaysia. At any rate, it was in Asia, in that part of Southeast Asia. And he was on a diplomatic trip, and he was introduced to the Queen. And the first thing Johnson did is go up to her and give her a big bear hug. Well, as you can imagine, the reason I'm telling this story is because in this particular country, as in England, no one touches the Queen.
Right.
Okay. And that's, you know, that's obviously, that was like the number one rule, that nobody touches the Queen, which indicates that you don't give her a big bear hug. And then he was on the same trip and he crossed his legs while he was talking. And had his a boot, you know, because he was wearing a pair of boots. He was a Texas guy, and I love to point that out. But he was wearing a pair of boots and had his boot pointed at the king of a different country, mm-hmm. which also turned out to be in that country an insult. If you cross your legs and point your boot at somebody, it was an insult. Now it's not here. So, you know, you can see how he could be forgiven for that. Sure. However, when you travel abroad, you are supposed to know things like that.
And have advisors
who
can point, and that's where you're going here, is to point this out so he doesn't make these mistakes.
Exactly. And you know, that way, unnecessary mistakes definitely aren't made. Now, this is from the LA Times this morning that... Okay, well, I'll tell you what. We're gonna get to this after the news because we need to take a break again right now, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Listen for our local news in just about 3.5 minutes.
This is Idaho Talks Live today at 10. Listen to Rush on 670 KBOI.
On a strange Thursday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Really odd. It's just noticing as I changed my page here that 24 former Broncos?
Yeah.
Are in NFL camps at this point in time for the National Football League.
Any that we would be surprised about?
No, I think we know who the mm-hmm. the usual suspects are. And then 35 from the state of Idaho.
Oh, terrific.
With Idaho ties.
What I was talking about before we went to break, before we went to the news, there's an analysis in the LA Times that says the president's war against elites,
mm-hmm.
which we knew. And
do you find it strange?
But also against expertise, that a billionaire would be going against the elites?
Yeah. Yeah, do you find it? I find that so bizarre.
Well, but he doesn't mean
it's never mentioned.
But he doesn't mean like the New York elites or just the elites. About basically, he means the Washington rank and file,
like political elites.
Yeah. But here's what it said. When President Trump campaigned this spring at the Hermitage, which is
a nice little shack,
the home of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
One part of his predecessor's approach got a special endorsement. It was during the revolution that Jackson first confronted and defied an arrogant elite. Does that sound familiar?
Yep.
Trump asked to laughs from his audience when Trump ally and National Rifle Association President Wayne LaPierre teed off 6 weeks later on America's greatest domestic threats. He cited not homegrown terrorists, but what he termed the three most dangerous voices in America: academic elites, political elites, and media elites. The rhetoric against elites came from two men who would seem to be, as you were starting to point out there, card-carrying members of the club.
Right.
LaPierre made more than $5 million in 2015, the most recent year for which his compensation was publicly released. Trump lived before his inauguration in a gold-plated home in the sky above New York's Fifth Avenue.
No question.
A billionaire's luxurious domain. Yet, for the president and his allies, a war on elites has been central to the campaign, which put him in the presidency and has maintained the loyalty of his core voters.
This is so bizarre out right now.
The president has taken particular aim at entities that could counter his power, which has helped stoke the ardor of his political backers. Among his targets so far, the government's intelligence agencies, the media, foreign allies, the Department of Justice, establishment politicians, scientists, and the Congressional Budget Office. The last has played a large role in raising questions about Republican proposals to repeal and replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, leading to a furious White House assault on its competence. The president has refused to accept the judgment of the intelligence agencies that Russia interfered with the 2016 election. He has alleged, without necessarily proof and contrary to both Democratic and Republican officials in key states, that millions of illegal voters cast ballots last year.
Mm-hmm.
He has blamed vaccines for autism, despite the scientific debunking of that notion.
Lack of proof.
Excoriating elites is classic populist language, according to Yale historian Beverly Gage. The president has taken it to a whole new level by not only attacking clueless elites, but the entire idea of expertise. In other words, you know, there's no point in having a PhD in something if you've read some headlines.
Yeah.
Now, to voters listening for them, Trump's anti-elitism signals have blared. As telling as his political and policy postures is his language, who else but the president would angrily call his predecessor's signature program a big, fat, ugly lie and a perpetual sense of victimization? He's a billionaire and therefore a member of a certain type of elites, but he's also the guy from Queens rebelling against the know-it-all smarty pantses from Manhattan.
Which some people forget.
Yeah. Trump has used both specific insults and the specter of powerful and mysterious external forces. He often describes them as an undefined they. They are the ones who are responsible for your lot in life.
Which we talked about earlier.
They are the people who are holding you down. They are the reason you don't make more money. They are the reason that you don't have more.
Who are these? They
arrayed against common Americans with him as the chief defender. Now, we have accomplished so much and we are being given credit for so little, he said last week as he announced his new communications director, Anthony Scaramucci. The good news is the people get it, even if the media doesn't. Now, us against them positioning has been common during populist eras in American politics for 200 years, that the man fueling it arose from elite social status is not uncommon either. The colonial leaders who bucked British control were the elite of their day, wealthier and more educated than those they led into the revolution. But they were able to persuade followers that they shared sentiments more powerful than social standing. You know, and there are critics of the American Revolution who say that despite what they said it was actually about landowners
getting land
in the colonies who wanted to keep their land and not pay any taxes to the king.
Yep.
And what they said was, well, we don't want taxation without representation. And those who criticize simply the whole idea of what they did said, no, all they didn't want was taxation. Now is then who...
And there's some truth there.
Well, possibly. I mean, I don't want to denigrate, you know, the...
Of course.
The founding fathers at
sure.
all. Because I kind of like what they created.
Because they may have had ulterior motives.
Yeah. Now as then, who and what represents the distasteful elite is almost entirely in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. It is a worldview. It really isn't dependent on education status or income. That's what Jeffrey Bell said. Now, he's the author of a book called Populism and Elitism, which came out clear back in like 1992. And he describes himself as a populist, despite his education at an elite university, Columbia, which is, and Trump himself went to an Ivy League school, Penn. What has mattered, he said, is an objection to power being centralized in government or among distant leaders. Now, in early American history, populist sentiments led farmers to rebel against more urban coastal elites. The only coast with political power at the time was the East. The West Coast has since become another symbol of elitism, particularly when the gaze is fixed on California and Hollywood. And often San Francisco can go in there, and so can Seattle.
Sure.
Helpfully for the president, the states he needed to turn his way in November already possessed strong veins of populism, making their votes more, or their voters, I mean, more receptive than those in other states to his message. And among the key states were Iowa and Wisconsin, you know, in the middle of the country. Now, in Iowa, Republican Party Chairman Jeff Kaufman said that the president's nearly 10-point victory relied in no small part on shared distaste for the elites the president spent his campaign scorning. And this is true, probably with the exception of two places in Iowa, and those places are Iowa City and Ames, where there are universities.
Yep.
All right, it's 9:45. We'll take a short break and be back with more.
Remember, you are listening to Idaho Talks Live on 670 KBOI.
Put those little bicep floaties on.
I knew a guy several years ago.
That's a big kid.
Who was married to somebody who had mental issues, mm-hmm. had kind of developed schizophrenia.
Sure.
And when they were talking it over with doctors and different people about what sort of treatment she should have, this guy kept saying, well, Jason says this and Jason says that. And Jason says, and he was talking to doctors and other people who had expertise in the matter.
Sure.
And the guy he was talking about was a friend of his who was a teenager. And he kept quoting him.
Wow.
Saying that, you know, this is what I heard. And you hear a lot of that. You hear a lot of people just saying, you know, well, I heard this. Mm-hmm. Or, you know what I think. And it's based on nothing.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because quite often, if you're not a person who... Let's say you're not a person who studies.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a person who reads a lot. You're not a person necessarily who went to, you know, certain kinds of colleges.
Right.
That if you are introduced to somebody who is supposed to be an expert on something, there's this idea that they barely know more about it than anybody else. They just have a theory. That's it.
True.
Which, well, that's the idea. But I don't know. That's not really how I've ever looked at it. There are people who have dedicated their life to studying economics. Now, the problem with that is that there are people who have dedicated their lives to studying things that come up with completely different answers. And I think that's where people start to get suspicious of what they consider to be the elites or the academic elites, is that they can't all agree on things.
See, and that's where political distrust starts, too.
Yeah.
I mean, say you're conservative, I'm liberal.
Mm-hmm.
We study our philosophies all through college, et cetera, into our forays into the working world.
Right.
I come to one conclusion.
And I come to another.
180 degrees from yours.
Yeah, exactly.
How is that possible?
Well, and a lot of times it
considering
has to do...
Considering we're both
have
a brain.
There are flaws when you study. There are flaws when you take... a poll, Like for instance, if somebody calls you up on the phone and says, "Okay, I want to ask you a couple of poll questions."
Sure.
And they said, "Do you think there's any way that our wonderful president could get more wonderful?"
Yeah.
And there are ways of swaying. If you said yes or no, either way, you are in a category now that just goes ahead and admits that the president is wonderful.
Right.
Now, that's kind of a
whether you believe it or not.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of a I don't know. That's kind of a fanciful example. But there are polls that are like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you think that cigarettes should be outlawed or just discouraged? Well, what if you like cigarettes?
Which I did.
Yeah, you that's
but
true.
I knew they should be outlawed because they were killing me.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Or if not outlawed, at least you should choose not to have them for your own personal health.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with that, though, is that there are people, and reporters do this too, and reporters are sometimes occasionally guilty of it. Not all. Some are pretty good. Some are pretty objective. But if you are subjective going into the study of a story or the study of any particular area of discipline in college, and you are looking only for results that agree with your ideology,
mm-hmm.
that's all you're going to find.
Right.
You're going to see things that disagree with what you say, and you're going to discount them as though that's not important. And like, for instance, if you're just at a cocktail party and you talk to 60 people at the cocktail party and you all talk about political theories and four of them agree with you and the other 56 don't, you're going to go around telling people, "Hey, I met four people the other night who absolutely agree with me."
Exactly.
You probably won't mention the people who don't agree with you. And that's where the problem comes in with a lot of different studies and a lot of reporting. Now, in Iowa, Republican Party Chairman Jeff Kaufman, as I said that the president's nearly 10-point victory there relied in no small part on shared distaste for the elites that the president spent his campaign scorning.
Right.
Populism, he said, really probably is a better explanation for the election in Iowa than party or religious influence. We really fit what he was standing for, pushing back against the establishment Democrats and establishment Republicans, both, and trying to find the working class voter. Now, this partially would explain why during the 6 months that that President Trump has been in office, he has done things the opposite of what the Republican Party would do. And chastised them and has still been okay with Republicans. Because I think the people who voted for him weren't necessarily voting straight Republican or straight Democrat ticket. They wanted something that just did not represent what they've become used to.
True. See you tomorrow with an Open Phones Friday. Have a wonderful afternoon.